And John Hogue with us. Final hour to go. We'll open up the phone lines, and we'll come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, John Hogue with us. John, Revelation, how does that tie into the prophecies of Nostradamus, Stormberger, and Casey?
Well, it does to a certain extent. There are certainly references in the Bible that would look at why we look towards Medigio Armageddon as the place of the final battle. And it ties into the fact that there's a lot of prophecy that points to the Middle East, the proxies of this new Cold War, waging, being the trigger that drags everybody into it. And so from that point of view, there is a connection. The thing that, if you look at the other visions about World War III from these group of people, you notice that they will describe nuclear winter.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the Norse Eddas predict. They talk about heavy snows are driven and fall from the world's four corners. The murdering frost prevails. The sun darkened at noon. And men wait for summer in vain. Twice winter follows winter over the world. Snow smitten, frost fettered, and chained in ice. Now, when we don't have the amount of nuclear weapons that we had in the 80s, that were pushing 80,000 in the world, but the number of about 8,500 Russian ICBMs and weapons and 7,500, if you include the NATO forces, an equal number of 8,500 or so atomic weapons in the West, is more than enough to trigger through the dust and debris that would rise from hundreds, if not thousands, of cities being atomically attacked to create a blocking out of the sun of global warming. And then there's also the prophecies of the German-Swiss seer Emma Kunz in the early 20th century, who talked about how men would fly on pencil planes, but these pencil planes would also eventually cut holes in the atmosphere, letting in lethal rays from space.
Mm-hmm.
What we know scientifically is that if there's a thermonuclear war, the detonations of atomic weapons will rip open the ozone holes. It'll be like Swiss cheese all over the world. And for about 100 years before it repairs itself, there will be a lot of lethal cosmic rays that will come in. And even after the nuclear winter, it'll be very dangerous to be out in the sun too long and catch cancers, cataracts, all kinds of problems. So she saw them as, it's funny because the pencil planes, the Atlas, the Redstone, the different rockets that we use to fly Mercury and Gemini astronauts, and also Vostok and Soyuz Russian cosmonauts, were basically mounted on ICBMs that were also going to be used in the last Cold War. So she said that in the turn of the last century. And 50 years later or so, these pencil planes existed. Now, Jesus talks about the Third World War in a way, too, when he talks about immediately after the suffering of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. Now, that could be a reference to nuclear winter. And the stars will fall from the sky. And the power of the universe, that's splitting the atom, perhaps, because this is the subatomic power that links the universe together, will be shaken. That's nuclear detonations. You see, a lot of prophets talk from different traditions talk about stars being grabbed from the sky and hurled down on towns and cities. A fusion bomb, hydrogen bomb, is basically a mini man-made star. And when it ignites, it is doing in a brief, terrifying moment what the sun is constantly doing throughout its life. It's creating fusion. So if you're seeing these things and having some understanding from your vision what they are, but not the language of the times to understand and describe it as it truly is, you might call it metaphorically a star cast down from the sky. I mean, St. Odile had a similar visions. In 720 CE, she said, the horrible warriors will unleash it, and his enemies will call him Antichrist. All nations of the earth will fight each other in this war. The fighters will rise up in the heavens, rockets launching perhaps, to take the stars and will throw them on cities, to set ablaze the buildings and cause immense devastations. The nations will cry, peace, peace, but there will be no peace. And Stormberger concurs with this. He says, in one day, more men will die than in all previous wars combined. Basically, then it's the doomsday body count, which is also shared by these visionaries.
They all see that.
Two-thirds of the human race destroyed in this war. And Nostradamus sees it that way, and a number of others in the book I list, including St. John of Book of Revelation.
Then how can we avoid that, John? If all these great prophets see the same thing, it sounds like there's no hope.
Well, this is why I end the book on Edgar Cayce, because not only is he equally accurate in predicting world wars, but he never saw a third world war. It's not recorded in his readings or his waking dreams, his waking visions, which were a few when he wasn't in trance. The only thing close that I've found that has any reference to future war is a very vague reference to a future life when he is taken up in the year 2100 into a cigar-shaped ship by two scientists with long beards and thick pop bottle glasses. They're trying to investigate if he is the reincarnation of Edgar Cayce, so they take him in this airship, this UFO-like ship, over what's left of the United States after great Earth changes.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And he sees New York City, and he says, New York City, it looks like it's being rebuilt from being devastated. I don't know if it was devastated by a war or by natural disaster. And that's basically it. That's the only... See, Cayce, people ask me, well, didn't he see the Cold War coming? Most of the questions he was asked and he was responding to in his final days were about the war that was still raging. And in fact, he died in January 45, about 4 or 5 months before the European theater ended, and before September 2nd, 1945, when the whole war ended. So he never really talked about a future war, world war. But he talked about enough things in the future that did happen, like the civil rights movement, like and other things, that shows that he was seeing beyond his own lifetime things in some of his Earth Changes prophecies, the first wave of which were dated for the late 50s and early 60s, were quite accurate, even though his second set for after 1998 were not, which people thought would be an axis shift of the Earth and all that didn't happen. So Cayce also believed in free will changing the future. So he doesn't talk about a third world war, but what Edgar Cayce does talk about, and it's very bold what he was saying, because he started saying it in 1934, 32 and 34, and all the way till the last full year of his life, 1944, he consistently comes back to in his readings to this vision of Russia as the hope of the world. Now, he was saying this in the depths of the Bolshevik scare of the early 30s, and then also with the growing concern that Russia under Stalin and the communists, even though they were our allies, things were starting to go sour with them towards the end of World War II. But he makes it very clear in these readings that not Bolshevism, not communism, he basically talks about a time when Russia... And he even describes the colors in a symbolic way of the Russian tricolor coming back, of the fact that Christianity would come back to Russia, a time when Russia would again embrace Christianity, which means after the communists were gone and their atheistic views on religion, that Russia would become this hope of the world, but it could not fulfill this destiny of bringing peace and balance to the world without our help, without the help of America. Cayce, like me, like you, we're Americans. But Cayce was very clear that it's not the kind of world that Victoria Nuland in her speeches is saying of how they're going to make Russia a better place. He's very clear that our hypocrisy, our saying one thing and doing another, our not living by the examples of our constitutional tenets, is not the destiny that will fulfill this vision of his. We have to kind of get a little more humble than we've been, take a look at ourselves long and hard, and kind of back off from this aggressive, neoconservative, exceptionalist stance that we're taking in the world, because that's going to kill this future. That's going to create the Third World War. If America leads, I mean, I can show you in the book that there are whole tracts of manifestos of neoconservatives that basically look at Americans living by example as something cowardly and unheroic, and that line of thinking will lead us to a Third World War. If we live by going back to the purity of the founding fathers, if we start taking stock of America as our Constitution has actually expressed it, not as people misinterpret it, if we live by the example of our American dream, that concept of freedom, then we will help teach Russia to be less oligarchic. The czars will fade, because actually that, strangely enough, is what, for whether it means it or not, Vladimir Putin has made it very clear that the eventual direction of Russia is away from a dictatorial regime and towards modern democracy.
Sure. But he'd like to be around forever, though, wouldn't he?
No, that's all propaganda. I'm amazed at the press. I can go in online and I can find speeches in real time. I can read what the man actually said. And I'm amazed how the characterizations of him are very misleading. Clearly there's an agenda to make him into an enemy. And that's never a good stance to have, even if you're dealing with somebody competing with you, because you're like Khrushchev, looking over the horizon saying, why can't I put missiles next door to America? And look how that almost blew the world up, because he didn't understand Americans. We don't understand Russians, and we need to start understanding if you want to be around, because if two-thirds of the world dies, it's not going to be one out of two Americans surviving. If there's a thermonuclear war, almost all of us will, in this country, will be annihilated, as will the Russians, because we'll be the main targets.
Okay, let's take some calls here for you, John, and we'll finish up with more calls in the next half. We've got Mark in Oregon. Welcome to the program. Mark, go ahead.
Well, thank you, George, and really an honor to speak to you, two good gentlemen. I really want to ask John if he would just give a thumbnail sketch biography of Nostradamus, and also I'd have one other question, if I may.
Okay.
Nostradamus was born in 1503 in the south of France. He was a physician by profession, but he was also an author of best-selling almanacs. He had a highly successful cosmetics industry, cottage industry. He became the talk of the courts of Europe because of his serialized history of the future called Les Prophéties, the prophecies. And unlike most people who believe that prophets should never make a profit, he never gave a prophecy that he didn't get paid for.
I understand he was a Christian and also a scryer, and that was his predominant method.
He was born in a Jewish family that had converted to Christianity, mainly, I think, to avoid the pogrom that the French king was going when the French annexed Provence, which was their own kingdom at that time. So they, like many Jews did in those days, they put on the mantle of Christianity, but secretly kept worshiping the Old Testament as well. And he was, so it's kind of ambiguous where he was at with that. He was officially a Catholic, but I think he saw the word, the Greek word for universal, to mean big enough to contain the contradictions of Christianity and Judaism as his faith.
And he was also a scryer. That was his predominant means.
No, he was a theurgist. He was a theurgist. As predominant, that means he basically was a channeler of what he called angels of fire, although there were other elemental angels or of higher. Basically, he contacted people, and to put it in modern terms rather than classical terms, he contacted people in higher planes and lower planes to basically hear, smell, and see, and be talked to by these spirits that told him what the future would be like.
John, just one last question, and that is, coming up to our present time, we're looking at this BRICS formation. They've already got $100 million into their central bank, I understand. They're setting this up, and they will control the economy of the world now. Is this a front to circumvent or appear to circumvent the Rothschild banking, you might say, transatlantic banking system, which through the Federal Reserve note controls the economy of the world essentially, at least since 1944, on a formal economic basis? Now, could this be a ruse in order to have people accept a one-world currency and everything else that comes with it?
No, actually, what it's going to create is a multiple currency world, and maybe that will eventually evolve into something else. But this is a struggle. This is a struggle of since 1944, when America was the one economy left standing. We were in the opportunity to kind of dictate, and rightfully most of the time, a rebuilding of the world after World War II. But we're not living in that time anymore, and as many mistakes of history, like 1914, are based on people making decisions from a mindset that's 20, 30 years off target, but making archaic decisions using the tools, in this case the economy, in very wrong ways, we are basically self-destructing with our fiat economy. The world needs to get together and actually do what they did in 44 and create a new system. Otherwise, as soon as 2016, we're going to see another boom bust of the fiat economy.
And many people are predicting that too, John.
Yeah, I've been one of them for many years. And what is also happening too is that history goes on. We had our American century. Now the Chinese are about to start theirs. Whether they will fulfill their century or not, because we could go on for a whole show about the great giant Chinese economy on its clay feet, which I also write about in my books. But basically, it could... anyway. That's all I have to say about that.
And we shall be back with Final Calls with John Hogue in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, former New York City police officer Ralph Sarchi joins us, talking about Deliver Us from Evil, a New York City cop investigates the supernatural. Make sure you're part of that show. And the first hour, John Rappaport joins us, and he will be talking about infectious diseases and Ebola. We'll come back in a moment with John Hogue and take John Hogue, rather, and take your final calls on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, John Hogue with us. John, did Stormberger ever talk about the Antichrist in any of his prophetic writings?
Not really. Not really. Nostradamus did a lot of talking about the Antichrist, and of course it was a unique take. He saw three Antichrists, and first one was Napoleon, called him Paul Ney Laurent, or Napoleon Noir, Napoleon King. Second was named after the ancient name of the Danube River, Hister, which is Adolf Hitler. He was born on the Danube. He wasn't born, he grew up on the Danube River. And the third is called Mabus, which is a code name that's been the focus of one of my books, Nostradamus and the Antichrist, codenamed Mabus, which is available at HogueProphecy.com. And that looks at all the possible candidates. Two of them are American presidents, and two of them are Arab leaders. Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden are the Arab candidates, chief candidates. And the current and the previous president are also candidates because they're all four of their names do convert to the laws of anagram to spell M-A-B-U-S, Mabus.
To the phones we go. We'll wrap things up. Jesse in Kentucky, welcome to the program. Jesse, go ahead. You're on with John Hogue.
Hi, can you hear me?
We sure can.
We can.
Awesome. Okay. I live like deep out in the woods. It's hard to get cell reception out here sometimes. Great to talk to you guys. Mr. Hogue, I'm so glad that you're doing this. Especially for people like me, I've got limited media. I don't have internet or cable at home. I listen to Coast to Coast every night. I love your show, George. It's great. Oh,
thanks.
So thanks. Keep plugging the word out there. I had a question about have you been predicting anything, Mr. Hogue, for Central South America and as far as maybe anything that's going on there concerning all the immigrants that have been coming in or refugees or however you want to term that?
Actually, I've been writing about the evolution of the struggle to make some kind of reform for immigration reform since the predictions for 2009. And every year I update it to see when this Congress will do one thing or another to resolve the issue. As far as predictions, I do often focus a lot on Brazil because Brazil is emerging as one of the great countries, influential countries of the 21st century. It may very well be a competition to see whose century the 21st century is. Is it Brazil's century or the Chinese century? My sense is that it'll be less the Chinese century as the century goes forth and more Brazil's century. And also, I would add that the Southern Hemisphere it's time now for the Southern Hemisphere to really have an impact on human civilization that it hasn't had because of the Northern Hemisphere's dominance. That will happen in the 21st century.
You haven't said much about North Korea tonight. How come?
Well, it's not really part of this certain matrix right now. It certainly was earlier in 2013, but really not a part of this issue that's this Cold War that's brewing, at least for now. However, in my writings, I am talking a lot about China and this pivot to the Western Pacific that America is undergoing. I mean, it is interesting to note that when the crackdown in Ukraine was happening, President Obama went to China, only he didn't actually go there. He went to form more military alliances with people around China. And that's definitely going to be a big issue that I'll have to write about, the potentials of the future clash between Chinese and U.S. forces and the end of the aircraft carrier as a capital ship.
Let's go to Charlie in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma now. Hi, Charlie. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Gentlemen, as it pertains to what I would characterize as the hubris of nationalism and or its jingoism, which I believe we're hearing a lot of right now, as it pertains to Mr. Stormberger's statement about entering into war with eyes wide open, I think I have a take on this, which says, you know, generally speaking, we all dread war. We don't want to enter into a war. But after the war is over, you know, we kind of like the idea. So as it pertains to what he's saying, eyes wide open, for example, look at World War II and Mr. Chamberlain. The Allies or the historians of the Allied nations generally condemn Mr. Chamberlain as an appeaser, as opposed to the idea of him being a peacemaker. I'd like to know what you think about that, Mr. Hogue.
Well, the British government at the time decided when Chamberlain had to step down that Chamberlain was a good peacetime prime minister, but not very good in the time of war. He was, I would say, pretty naive to think that he would get these kind of solutions from Hitler. And I think he meant well, certainly. But the prophecy that Stormberger states in English, translated, is, with open eyes will the people of the world step into these great catastrophes. So the indication is, metaphorically, is more like falling into a wolf trap, not coming out the other side and thinking, you know, kind of like war. In fact, there's a lot of things about war that, I mean, a lot of people ask me, how can anybody go to war? It never is any good. People die. And I have to remind people that there are certain people in the world who make a lot of money in the death business. And the people who love peace and life need to stop being so Chamberlainly naive and sometimes have to fight back with peaceful means if they can, but if not, like we had to fight back with Hitler. Sometimes there is a time for war, and there's a time for peace. But, basically, I think that Stormberger was trying to warn us not to step into the catastrophe with our eyes wide open, more like the name of that movie, Eyes Wide Shut.
Eyes Wide Shut. And John, as we speak, Russia has doubled its forces along the Ukraine border.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I wanted to mention that yes, they've doubled their forces. There again, that's the penalty flag. But what pushed first is that Ukraine, as we speak, is now preparing to go into Lugansk and Donetsk with a full military attack. And so,
and I don't think the Russians are going to let that happen.
This is a very dangerous development,
it
because
sure is.
This is what could happen, which is very 1914. Ugh. They go in. You think Gaza is a bad situation. This is Gaza times 10. The Russians, either there's an incident on the border, or the Russians decide to go in and protect their interests with the Lugansk and Donetsk, Donbass people, then you've got now suddenly a war between Ukraine and Russia.
And do now, we get involved in that? Do we go in there?
The proxies, then, since we've already sent Academy, Blackwater people, since we're already sending military advisors, since we're already trying to make new deals for new business, war business, with the Ukrainian army, train it, arm it, we are now getting involved. It's like sending observers and trainers into Vietnam, into all the civil wars that America since Vietnam gets itself messed up into. We never seem to learn our lesson. It always ends up a mess, and we seem to be stepping into a mess. This mess could end up into a real Cold War that could go nuclear hot in 3 years and 7 months or 13 years. That's the long term. There's an alternative future timeline that says that it takes 13 years for the Third World War to happen. Very dangerous the next few weeks, very dangerous, because you have people following their own narratives, they're projecting on each other, and I have to say for the record, as much as you're hearing otherwise, the Russians are actually more rational in this. They've made their blunders and they've made their nationalistic mistakes too, but they're actually being more rational than we are. Putin is actually behaving far more rationally than Barack Obama and the Secretary of State in Chief, who is his new Dick Cheney. I mean,
nobody could be Dick Cheney, John, huh?
Yeah, well, I don't know. John Kerry, who's a skull and bonesman.
Yes, he was.
And is. I've been writing about him since the Antichrist book, basically showing how the Skull and Bones people decided on the B team after the A team. The Republicans in the White House didn't work out. Now they're going to the B team, which he represents. And that I kind of jokingly call him the Secretary of State in Chief, just like I used to jokingly call Cheney the Vice President in Chief of a weak president. We've had two weak presidents in
right.
Yeah, and now we may follow up with a very hawkish John McCain in skirts.
You never know. Eddie is in Pennsylvania. Hi, Ed. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
There's been reports of divine intervention going on in the Gaza-Israel war on both sides, and it's just interesting to me that the West mostly doesn't even know that the Gazan terror group Hamas, their charter says their existence is to kill all Jews in the world, not just Israel. It's like they wave Nazi German flags in the Palestinian so-called territories. It's like World War II never really ended for them. Their Mufti, the Mufti of Jerusalem,
yes,
of Palestine, was Hitler's best friend. He paid him 50,000 Reichsmarks a month.
Yes.
That's quadruple what the highest paid general in the German military received. To go in broadcast from Berlin that they were going to kill all the Jews in the world.
Yes.
So that they wouldn't can I say
something?
British Palestine.
Yes, yes. Can I say something? We don't need the whole... Let me say something. That's all true. And Hamas, it can be no peace if Hamas is dedicated to the destruction of the Jewish state. It's just a reality. It is also a reality that they are putting their bases underneath. They are using their people as human shields. That is all true. But it is also true that as the Second World War is still being fought by the people who love the Mufti of Palestine, there are a lot of people on the extreme right in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv that are still waging the Warsaw Ghetto, and now it's Gaza. There are supremacists on both sides of this issue that are the right-wing Zionist supremacists and the Islamic jihadists are putting the people of Palestine and the Jewish state in their crossfire. And it has to end, or both will be destroyed.
There's no question about that, John. Ed, thanks for your call. Let's take a few more here. We'll go to Reading, Pennsylvania. Kenita, first-time caller. Hi there.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Hi.
Good to have you with
us. Hi. Thank you.
Go ahead.
This is just a very simple question. I was just going to ask, is there any place in the world that anybody can seek refuge? Because it seems like this is about to get really crazy and hectic around here.
Yes. The refuge is just above your wandering feet, if you ask me. The refuge is within. This is a planetary issue, so there's no safe place physically, per se. And yes, I understand the idea of escaping to a safe place to weather it out. I guess if I have a bias towards the situation, I'm not a survivalist. I would rather be at ground zero trying to stop this future, this dire future from happening, even if I'm right in target of a thermonuclear bomb in the process. I think the way to make the world safe or to find a safe area is to make the world safe, and that means we have to take a look at what makes us make such a mess in the world. And my solution to that is the science of self-observation, which I've been practicing since 1980. I learned it in India, and I am living it in my life. If some of you think my ideas are original in my writing, it's probably because of the meditations that I do, which makes me look at myself and the mechanics of my own dysfunction and see how that projected on the collective is really what everybody is going through. It's the identification with nation, religion, borrowed knowledge, borrowed identities that has basically made us habitually divided against ourselves and each other. We see the world in a skewered way. We do our best to make it better, but we don't look at the mess that's the motivation inside of us. It's the way we've been trained and conditioned. And meditation, I contend, helps a person see the robotic habitual behavior that causes this misery go around called the repeating of history. And when you start seeing it, you shine. It's like a light of understanding begins to make you free of it. And then the God-given, existence-given intelligence that you all born with begins to awaken because it's no longer under the coding of ego and of identity. It's no longer you become the driver of your body, mind, your vehicle in life, rather than think you're the car. Because the society wants you to think you're a dead, dumb automobile, not the driver, the soul, the witnessing consciousness of your car, your vehicle. So for me, Osho's one of my favorite mystics, and he talked about how there's not going to be a Noah's Ark to save us this time around. There's going to be a Noah's Ark of consciousness, that the consciousness within each of you is the Ark of the Covenant. It is the way to live by example, and by your example, change the world.
Do you have hope for the future, John?
No, because if you have hope, you hide hopelessness. I am free of both. I've understood that for things to really work, one has to abandon hope, and then you abandon also hopelessness. You know, one has to abandon good so that you can let go of evil.
Of the three prophets we've talked about tonight, Nostradamus, Stormberger, and Edgar Cayce, is there one above the other, or are they all about the same?
Well, I hope that our actions, when faced with these prophecies, they're so clearly warning us where not to go, that we will make... In God we trust, some people say. In the end of the book, I say, in Cayce I trust, that his prophecy will be made right, and Nostradamus's and Stormberger's and the others will be made wrong by our actions. It's just like I was saying 3 hours ago. There was a choice. The king of France was given by Nostradamus to become the second Charlemagne and bring peace to his land. He chose the other course, which was to die in a jousting accident, which caused 9 civil wars. We have the free will to make Edgar Cayce the better prophet or Nostradamus. Which shall it be? I ask all of you.
Good question.
Which
John,
shall it be?
Once again, my friend, thank you for being on the program. You take care of yourself.
Thank you very much, George, for having me.
John Hogue and his prophecies. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.